This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 130. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, from all different skill levels, shooting all different types of photography. And this is our time every week to sit down and get our weekly dose of photography knowledge. We have a lot to talk about this week, as all of us have been active and shooting. Darren and Brian and I have been in Chicago this last week, and so we've been doing a lot of shooting, and so there's a lot to talk about. And to join me today, we have Jeff Harmon and Darren Meller, Nick Page, and Brian McGuckin. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hey.
Aloha.
Well, let's get things started right away by jumping into a reader question, and I am going to throw this first one to Nick. The question from Anonymous, posted on improvephotography.com in the Q&A section is, I had an interview with a group of wedding photographers looking for a second shooter or assistant job to gain some experience in the wedding photography industry. And they told me I have to have a full frame camera to even shoot for them. My soul was crushed. Her soul. Wow. I know my T3i is entry level, but I love it. And I have even considered upgrading to the T6 when money permits. Should I consider full frame instead so that I can be taken seriously in the wedding photography world? What do you think, Nick?
Well, it can be done with a crop sensor. Let's just get that out of the way right now. But there's a definite advantage to having a full frame when you're shooting weddings. So many times when you're shooting a wedding, you're in an extremely low light environment. You know, if you're on a crop sensor and you're shooting at ISO 3200, which is not, you know, uncommon when you're in a reception type environment, those are going to be some super grainy photos. But, you know, if you're willing to set up some lighting and some speed lights and stuff during those receptions, you can get away with a lot lower ISOs. But it starts getting a lot more technically demanding when you start adding in that many speed lights and stuff. So you can definitely be taken serious with a crop sensor. Although if wedding photography is what you plan on pursuing, you know, as a career or as a side job, I think you really do get your money's worth with a full frame camera. And it doesn't have to be a 5D Mark III. It could be like a 5D Mark II, or you can get into a 6D now for more. If you get a used 6D, you can get into that more affordably than you could like a 7D Mark II new. So if weddings are really going to be what you're shooting, there's a lot to be said for a full frame camera, that or compensate for it by getting some really fast glass, like a, you know, a 51.4 or something like that.
Brian, do you agree with that?
I'm glad you asked me, because I agree to an extent. In the end, I think what matters most is how the images turn out. And if all you have is a crop sensor camera, and you can still create beautiful images that are going to please your clients, I think that's good enough for now. I know for myself, that's what I did for the first 3 years of shooting weddings. And that's probably about 20 to 25 weddings that I did with that. And my clients seemed happy and very pleased with them. So I think in the end, it just deals with being able to do the best with what you have. And if you can create a beautiful image with a crop sensor or a full frame, I don't think that fully matters as much. I mean, once you get the full frame, it's kind of like, you know, opening up a door to, wow, this is awesome what I can do with this. But I definitely don't think that it's necessary, especially for somebody who's starting out, to feel any pressure that, oh, I must get this right away.
Yeah, good pictures can be made with a crop sensor, no doubt about it. And the quality of the shot matters more than the noise in it, for sure. But when you are shooting weddings and you finally do make that upgrade from a crop sensor to a full frame, you do notice the difference. It's a substantial difference. And I'm just saying,
yeah, you notice your pocketbook is empty and your back aches at the end of the day. You're definitely going to notice when you're shooting full frame.
But your clients aren't going to notice it as much. Not unless they have an eye for it. I think they may start to see a difference in your images over time, but the majority of people are not going to notice that.
Although, I agree, Nick. I think you're full of crap on this one.
But the thing is,
full of crap on this. I think you have to shoot differently. You have to shoot differently. If you go and shoot with the crop sensor camera, really any of them, the same as you would with a full frame camera, it's not going to produce great results. It's just not. But like you said, stash a couple speed lights are in the venue and everything suddenly is fine. Totally fine once you do that. You know, maybe you've got to shoot for a little bit of a different shot. Maybe you can't bump your ISO all the way, but it's not like that's the only option, is to just go with crazy high ISOs. I understand what you're saying. Like when we're talking about the ultimate, we want the ultimate image quality. I haven't seen yet a crop sensor camera that can match what a full frame can do, just in terms of like image quality. But do you have to have that for a wedding? No. And do you have to have that to be taken seriously? Only by idiots. I mean, only by idiots. If somebody handed me a Nikon D7200 and said, Jim, go shoot a wedding, I would not have any problem. I would be just fine. I know you would too. I know you would, Nick. If I handed you a Canon T6i or a 70D and I said, go shoot a wedding, I know you would come back with a great wedding shoot.
Yes, but there's definitely going to be some shots that you can get with a full frame that you just couldn't get with a crop sensor.
Same is true in reverse. Mm-hmm. The same is true in reverse, mm-hmm. because I was just talking to you guys this week on Messenger. I love that we're always button heads, Nick. This is great. it's been like everything opinion. The last few episodes. I was talking to you guys in Messenger this week on that we always are kind of communicating with each other. And I was looking through my photos from China, and I could like count, not on just one hand, multiple shots in China that I missed because I remember, oh yeah, that would have looked cool, but I was just a little bit too wide on that because I didn't want to carry the 7200 around that day. It was too heavy. Whereas with a crop sensor, no problem. The lenses are a lot lighter and you get that extra focal length as well. So I think the same thing is true in reverse.
Okay. I'm not going to fully Touché. Agree with that, but because you can always get closer, right? Like you can get closer with that's what feet are for.
No, you can't always get closer.
In a wedding,
girl up in the window in China. That's the photo I was thinking about when I was doing this. It was a girl with long hair draping her hair out the window. I can't like fly. She's in the air. I had to zoom.
Yeah, and when I was shooting Formula One, Jim actually talked me into getting a crop sensor. There's no way I could have gotten closer to those cars because of the restrictions. So I bought a crop sensor, and that 400 millimeter lens instantly became 600.
Gang up on Nick.
My turn. So when I've shot some weddings, you're only allowed to go up so many aisles from the back at certain churches, at least around here. And so you just can't get that reach if you don't have that crop sensor. Or if you're on the sidelines of a football game, you need that extra oomph in order to get in tight on some of those shots.
That's true. But I've never been at a wedding and thought, man, I need more than 200 millimeters. Like I should bust out the 600 millimeter for this shot. Like I've never really felt that 200 millimeters wasn't enough.
I have.
And furthermore, by the time you compensate for needing that extra light with some extra speed lights, you've already bridged the gap in price between a crop sensor and a used Canon 6D because they're getting cheap. You know, you can spend $800 on a crop sensor or you could spend $1,000 on a full frame. If this is going to be something that they're doing for a while, why not spend that extra $200 and the difference will be paid for in the first wedding?
Except it's not just that $200. It's the lenses too.
That's true.
Most likely, if she's got a T3i, I think it's a she, right? Whoever it was. Anonymous, I guess. We don't know.
Anonymet, I think it was.
Okay. So we don't know. But whoever it was, if they got a T3i, I'm guessing there's probably kit lenses, stuff like that. So it's not just the $200 to get to that full frame body if you upgrade. It's all those lenses that you've got to get too. So it's a major investment.
Although a full frame with a 50 millimeter is, you know, that's not all that much more than a crop sensor, a kit lens, and then three speed lights to try to make enough light in the reception hall, you know?
The point I would say is I wouldn't say full frame is the next thing that this person should do because of the lens situation. The next thing would probably be to get some better lenses so that when you get a full frame eventually, if you ever decide that's the thing that's going to improve you next, you have lenses to go on it.
That's true. That is 100% right. I will agree with Jeff.
Nick, you put up a heck of a fight when you have all of us against you.
Well, you know, it hits right in my wheelhouse since I'm still a crop sensor shooter.
That's true. But
well, this is an interesting topic. And Nick, you made a lot of valid points. And, you know, to be honest, until like, well, 3 days ago, I would totally be on your side of the aisle on this one. But I don't know, as we were shooting in Chicago, And Darren and Brian and I walked like 24,000 steps one day all over that city shooting. It was like, I was just sick of carrying all that weight and crappy gear. It was so heavy. It rolled over on one of my speed lights and broke the LCD on the back of one of my speed lights on the way home. It's just so heavy. And I looked at how much money I've spent in the last year on Nikon gear. Holy cow. I mean, crazy. So expensive and so heavy. It's really got me thinking, is this seriously necessary to get 5, maybe 10% better optical quality when it has all these drawbacks that keep me from shooting? We need to talk about this in an episode. Maybe next week we have the smackdown on going lighter versus the full frame perfect image quality. But let's go on to the next question. Maybe this one will be a little bit less controversial. Hey guys, I'm looking at a used Nikon 7200 version 1. So an older lens, and I can get a really good deal on it. But the problem is that the focus stutters on autofocus single, and it doesn't focus at all on autofocus continuous. I've read that the repairs usually run $400 to $500. Do you have any tips on getting older lenses repaired and if parts are usually generally available? Darren, what do you think? Is this a buy or a no buy?
Well, that $400 to $500 repair kind of scares me. I mean, what's the difference in price between the version 1 and version 2 since, you know, I'm a Canon shooter?
I don't know what the old version one is. I mean, it's not sold by Nikon anymore, but I don't know what they're running on Amazon.
If he could make up the difference in between the price, you know, and justify that repair expense, I would say it's possibly a buy. But if you're going to have to repair it, knowing that out of the gate, I'm not sure if I'd buy it at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like hey, come by my house. There might be something wrong with the foundation. We don't know what it is, but there could be something. Like, you don't know what the problem is with this focus. You know, just because some lens repairs are $400 to $500 doesn't mean all the lens repairs are. So no way I'm buying this lens as having focus issues.
I'm a Canon shooter, so I had to look it up on eBay to see what these are selling for. And the version 1 of the 70-200 on Nikon is selling for, you know, a couple, maybe $100 cheaper than a brand new Tamron 70-200. And at this point, like, if it was me, I would probably go for the brand new Tamron that gets awesome reviews. Everybody seems to love them. And obviously, it's not going to have the problems as soon as you buy it. So another route might be to go with a Tamron version of the lens.
Great recommendation. I'd totally jump on board with that. Okay. Well, we want to go to the 5-minute segments. And so we each have 5 minutes to talk about something that we are working on. I'm going to throw this first one over to you, Mr. Nick.
Well, I just got back from Hawaii. I went to the island of Kauai, and it was my first ever trip to Hawaii. And it was quite the experience. I'm not acclimated to the mainland time. I'm still on island time. You know, I got to do quite a few things that I hadn't done before. Like, for example, I'd never done any kind of like underwater photography. And I before I went over, I rented a GoPro Hero 4. And so I was like out trying to shoot wave curls and shooting boogie boarders and stuff. And if you've never done it, shooting underwater is completely different and so much fun. Like, I don't know how many good shots I got, but that was probably the most fun I've had with photography in quite a while. We got to swim with sea turtles and stuff, and I got some pretty decent shots and videos of that. And a couple of the recommendations that I wanted to bring is that before I went over, I didn't pack any light stands or anything because I was actually there to shoot a wedding. But what I did pack was just a monopod. And I've used monopods tons for holding umbrellas and speed lights and softboxes and stuff. And it kind of served double duty on this trip because I not only did I use it for my speed lights and stuff when we were doing the wedding portraits and stuff, but I also used it with my GoPro the whole time. And so like when I was underwater swimming with sea life and stuff, I could extend it all the way out and then boom the GoPro like way close to whatever it was I was photographing. So it came in super handy for that. And I just got the really cheap Walmart one because obviously I'm going to be swimming in salt water with it. And I, at the end of the trip, I just threw it in the garbage can because it was like $25 and all covered in corrosion and ruined. Don't do it with a good monopod, but it came in super handy for that. And also, another thing I had to keep in mind was protecting my lenses from all the sand blowing around and the sea salt splashing up onto my camera. So I was actually using UV filters and trying to keep my camera clean, and that was a huge issue for throughout the whole trip, because every single day I had to wipe down my camera, and I went through like I don't know an entire package of those little Zeiss alcoholic wet wipe thingies that you can get at Walmart. You know what I'm talking about, those mm-hmm. little single use things. And another thing that I kind of wanted to bring up is that I was only going to be there for 9 days, which seems like a long time, but this is such an expensive once in a lifetime trip. I wanted to make the most of it. So I was getting up for sunrise every single day I was there, whether I felt like it or not, which was most of the time not. I got out and I shot every single sunrise and every single sunset. And because of that, I was super tired at the time, but I went home with a ton of photos that I'm excited about. So that's kind of my experience with Hawaii. I can't wait to go back. I was trying to figure out how to ship my child over to me so I didn't have to come home, but
it was. And what were you shooting underwater? Were you shooting like fish and stuff or waves or what?
Well, yeah. So with the GoPro, I was shooting fish and sea turtles, like I said, and I was also there with the bride and the groom. And so when they were out boogie boarding and stuff, I was like getting in close and getting shots of them going through. And while I was there, there was actually another photographer there that had their, it was like a Canon Rebel, but they had the underwater housing for it. And she let me use it for like a couple hours. And so I got my first experience using one of those big metal housings. And that is so much fun. I still haven't got to see the photos that I took with it because she's still got my SD card. But shooting with those underwater housings is just a ton of fun. And with that, I was shooting boogie boarding and surfing and stuff. So I don't know that I got tons of great shots, but it was just a ton of fun, and I highly recommend somebody trying it if you've never tried it before.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Were the waves curling over enough this time of year to get the kind of wave shots that we've seen everybody doing? Or
yeah,
I mean, the waves in Hawaii are a lot bigger during the winter. Were they big right. enough to get a nice curl?
Yeah, it was big enough that like I got hurt a couple times because it's also like kind of a super dangerous thing to photograph because I'd never been in surf quite that big, but these were like, I don't know, like 6-7 foot waves. And so I was out and smiling and trying to take pictures, and then occasionally a wave would just crash right on top of me and slam me against the bottom. And one time, oh, I forgot to tell this story. One time I was just packing the GoPro around like in my hands, and one time a wave hit me so hard that I dropped it. And it was seriously like a minute before I could find it in the surf because all these waves are coming in and crashing in. And
whoops.
Yeah, it was a big deal. But somehow I found it again. And I didn't tell the people that I rented it from that had happened. But
you've got a tech to them.
Exactly. So hold on tight and maybe put some kind of thing on your hand before you do that.
All right, Jeff, I'm just going to trust that this is going to be the geekiest 5 minutes of my week. What do you have for us?
I don't want to disappoint. So
no, actually I talked to several people on the workshop in Chicago that said, Jim, you got to stop teasing Jeff about his geeky stuff. We like it.
Well, good. That means there's more geeks out there. That's excellent. That means there's hope for Photo Taco. Okay, so I want to talk just briefly about Sony camera sensors. So it's going along a bit with the topic that we've been having on our Facebook Messenger chat about smaller cameras and so on. And the A7 II, or is it A7R2?
A7R2. A7R2, yeah. There's the A7 II as well.
Because that's the full frame sized with the R, right?
Well, they both are, but the A7R2 is the one that's the high resolution, everything that we've been talking about.
Anyway, lots of stuff going on there, right? Lots of development. We've been talking about how Canon and Nikon have been really falling behind, but you have to think too about Sony as a company overall. And there's been some reports with earnings and so on. So they made some news about that, and then they made some really big news today. But the company is really kind of struggling overall. Their revenue is like barely keeping in front of expenses, and that scares a lot of people. Their consumer brand has really fallen off and fallen behind. They're not doing nearly as well in like the TV market, for example, stuff like that. But the Wall Street Journal, in this financial news about them, said that the two very bright spots are with their camera sensors and the PlayStation. So that's kind of what the company's bread and butter is right now, with the camera sensors and the PlayStation. Which means it's really good.
And that
good.
Walkman, that's still pretty darn cool.
Yeah, I don't think so. So, and focusing on the sensors themselves, you know, they've been absolutely killing it. They supposedly, I don't know, the reports I read said that they supplied worldwide 40% of all the image sensors that were sold throughout the world in 2014. So
that's crazy.
That's a massive share of the market for that. It's included in the iPhone 6, in the Samsung S6, like the two latest, most popular smartphones have Sony sensors in them. Of course, Nikon's had them for a long time and are rated like the best in the world for their performance. They've been killing it. And Sony would have, the report said that they would have delivered even more than 40%, but they couldn't put them out fast enough. They couldn't deliver more than that. So what Sony announced today was that for the first time in 26 years, they are going to put out stocks and bonds to raise $4 billion to ramp up their research, development, and production capabilities so that they can better produce this and become a component provider for consumer electronics and cameras, rather than so much emphasis on the full brand as like a Sony TV and so on. So that's really interesting to me. It's made me wonder, well, Nikon's already there, but what should Canon do? Or what about these other camera manufacturers? But I think Canon's really almost the only one that still refuses to let go of that and is building their own sensors. And, you know, before the 5DS, I would have said they should just dump it. They're so far behind on the sensors that they should just adopt, get Sony to provide them their sensors too, and make it so that that's no longer a reason to not choose Canon because the sensors are so far behind. I think the 5DS closes the gap quite a bit, but the dynamic range, I think, is still a problem. I'm hearing that, or I'm reading that, that's still not quite caught up. So it's going to be really interesting, I think, as Sony goes and makes this massive investment and continues to really improve their sensors and the abilities that are there. What's Canon going to do? I think it's all good for us. That's the biggest message I wanted to get out of it, was there's really good stuff going on here, and that should only make things way better for us as photographers.
Yeah, that is good news. You brought up dynamic range. That I think this is like probably the most skipped over technical thing that when we talk about a new camera coming out, is because there's no like homegrown way to measure this. I mean, you can kind of take a picture looking into the sun, you know, and have a very high contrast scene. Like, let's say I'm taking a picture of Jeff Farman and he's backlit and the sun is streaming in straight through the lens behind him. If I take two cameras and shoot that same picture for a review, well, there are going to be differences just if I move the camera a millimeter one way or the other, just the way the light is filtering through the lens. And if it's a different lens, you know, you're talking about cameras of two different brands. So it's almost, I mean, it's really, really difficult to measure this in, you know, in somebody's blog post review of a camera. And so we often just don't see any numbers on dynamic range. But next time you watch a movie, watch the dynamic range. It's incredible the dynamic range that you see in movies, because they're using super, super high-end video cameras that have a dynamic range that just squashes our cameras. Right. And so you see shots even like during the middle of the day in a movie, and you can see hard shadows on the ground, but it isn't such a crazy dynamic range that you can't see the face clearly. It isn't such a crazy dynamic range that you can't see that shadow under the tree, you know, the detail in it. And you know, part of that is just the lighting of the movie. But even where, you know, you get a glimpse of how they've set up the lighting of a shot, those video cameras, some of them are just crushing what we can do with our still cameras. And it makes a huge difference in the way that you shoot when you don't have that dynamic range. So this is one that's difficult to measure, but it's really important area is that dynamic range.
Yeah, well, maybe it's the subject. I think maybe if we switched out Jeff Harmon for Nick wearing a coconut bra and a hula dress, that might be a little bit better.
Then we're like, I've got to see into the shadows. All right. Well, we want to go in and talk about more of these geeky subjects. But before we do, we want to take a second to thank some of the people that make the Improved Photography Podcast possible, and also the other shows that we have on the Improved Photography Network. And we offer them all for free. All right. And the first is discountfilters.com. So I'm the worst person when it comes to changing like the filter in our AC and heater. Like just this week, it was just scorching in Idaho. I got up to 108 degrees. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, in Celsius, but it was just so hot and our AC unit just couldn't keep up with it. And I thought, oh man, I'm going to have to call somebody to come out here and see if they can work on our AC. And then I realized like, oh, maybe you should just change your filter because it's been like 6 months and you change it and it's suddenly the air's circulating, everything's fine again. Plus the importance of just keeping the air fresh and clean in your home. So check out discountfilters.com. Now, the way that they do this is they remove the boneheaded mistakes that I may make like that. Once you sign up, they'll send you email reminders and tell you when it's time to replenish the filters in your house, your fridge, like the little filter for your water in your fridge. Mine just blinks continuously. So I need this. So check it out at discountfilters.com/improve. And that'll get you 10% off your first order. Take my mistake and learn from it at discountfilters.com/improve. And we really thank them for their support of the Improve Photography Podcast. And by Animoto. Animoto is my favorite way for creating slideshows for my photography. It's just simple. I'm going to a family reunion this weekend, and guess what? Animoto slideshow, because it's really easy to put together. Everything looks professional. It looks like you sat down and spent a lot of time putting together the slideshow, but really all you have to do is upload the photos, pick a quick song, and you can customize things, but it's pretty well done for you. And video is getting watched on the web like crazy. I mean, just absolutely crazy. When you see on Facebook those videos that your friend posted, just a little home video, look at that number underneath that says how many views it has. Often you'll see it like 400 views just for tiny little videos. So put videos of your photography up. It'll let your friends know about your photography services and keep you front on the mind when they need to find a photographer. When that friend that you aren't around very often but does see your Facebook status, it needs a photographer, they'll think of you. Great way to get your photography out there. So you can share your Animoto videos anywhere too. You can download them, burn them to a DVD, a lot of options for you. So go to animoto.com/improve and remember to use the promo code improve, and that'll get you 15% off to receive 15% off an annual pro subscription. And we thank them for their support of Improve Photography. Okay, well, we want to go on and talk about some of the more topics for today. I'm going to pass this next one over to Darren. Tell me what you're thinking about this week.
Well, we had a fun outing in Chicago, which we all heard about last week on the podcast, but I took a lot back with that, or took a lot home with me with that trip. And one thing was to shoot your own thing, and that's by taking info from others before you actually do it. And you can do that in a lot of ways. You can attend a photography workshop or conference like Jim, Brian, and I did in Chicago, and you're surrounded by creative minds. So that's kind of a win-win. You can also go on photo walks and take classes from other photographers and see how they make images. There was a great photographer out there who was a hoot. We listened to his presentations, and I think 50% of the class was laughter, and that was from Brian Peterson. And just the way he presents things, like saying that his daughter was out in a field getting pictures of flowers, and she's like, "Oh, daddy, there's bees." And he's like, "Do you want a college education? Stay out there." Just things like that just made the whole class just, you know, have uproars of laughter. And it was just so much fun to have an engaging way to learn how to take better photos, learn about composition, exposure, just the basics and fundamentals of photography. And not to toot Jim's horn, but also to go and listen to Jim talk about how to build a presence on social media and actually get your name out there. Concentrate on one thing, whether it be Facebook, Instagram, etc., and not spread yourself thin by trying to keep up with 4,000 different social media sites and chasing after the ones that might be dying, like Google Plus, or going after the ones like Twitter, where people are just posting something on a constant feed where no one can really keep up with. Another thing I learned on there was to also shoot F22. And this is probably going to be something Jim's going to hate, because we teach to shoot maybe F18 at the max because of diffraction. But this is something maybe Jim can talk about here. But Brian brought it up in his conversation in his class that he shoots F22 for the most part. Unless you're going to blow it up to be a rather large image, you're not really going to notice it. And it's going to help you be able to keep the foreground and the background both in focus. And my dad and I put this to practice, and we got some really great starburst when we were doing the actual star of the sun setting over the Chicago skyline. Also the city lights that were lighting up it in the blue hour. It just looked really amazing shooting at that high aperture that I've never dared to tread on before. So we could possibly talk about that as well. But last but not least, the main thing that I really learned there is to network with other people. You might not think that photographers who are standing around you are going to be the best people to work with, but you know, earlier in our Facebook conversation this week, we had Nick post, "Oh shoot, I scheduled two weddings on the same day," and he reached out to who? Other photographers, to see if we could possibly come out to Washington to shoot for him. I think he got that resolved with another local photographer. But you know, it's great to have these people be your friends on Facebook, Instagram, etc. You never know where that connection might lead you. So like I said, just keep on learning and stay doing what you love to do with image making. And that's really my tip this week.
Very cool. Well, I want to take 5 minutes and talk about Lightroom. We've had quite a few comments on Improved Photography asking, because we were pretty tough on Lightroom when the latest release of Lightroom 6 and Lightroom CC came out, that it was just super buggy. In fact, I said it was the buggiest release of Lightroom since Lightroom, and I really do mean that. And so people have been asking, we just haven't mentioned it since then, so people have been wondering kind of what we're thinking now and what issues we're seeing. I saw a dramatic improvement with the release that came out, 2-3 weeks ago, the update to Lightroom CC, but it is not all fixed. And in fact, I'm still seeing significant issues all when I'm taking a photo and round tripping. I've been trying to figure out what is causing the issues, but there's something messed up with round tripping in Lightroom that is causing a lot of the issues that I'm seeing. Not all of them. I have still, sometimes I import a photo, I move sliders, and everything's messed up. In fact, Brian, I think I showed you one in Chicago, that a photo that I would draw with the adjustment brush, make an adjustment, and then the little handle on the adjustment brush, you know, a little dot that shows up that you can click to move it again, it was just gone. It's just vanished. And the adjustment was still there. We could still see where I drew, but you couldn't change it anymore. It was just, it completely vanished, that little handle to move things. There are still a lot of bugs in Lightroom. It is still driving me absolutely bonkers, but I am seeing an improvement. Anybody else still seeing issues with Lightroom, or is it just me?
I think that you're a little bit contagious, because after coming back from Chicago, I had a shoot that I had to edit. And as I was doing it, I was having some issues with some sliders a little bit, with the contrast sliders and just a few of the other ones. And I never had that problem before.
So what was it? What was it doing for you?
Like, I would move it, and it wouldn't show the... It wouldn't show the change.
I've had that too.
It would like stutter. And so I even shut my computer down, restarted it, and it was still doing that.
Yeah. And the other thing, I've had that same thing. The other thing that I'm noticing is battery life is just draining so fast. I mean, Brian and I were sitting in a coffee shop, just editing. I was working on my presentation for the next day. And both of our batteries on our laptops just went down so fast. As soon as you open Lightroom, it's just chugging on the battery. Nick, about you?
I've definitely been experiencing issues with it too. It seems like it's not running quite as slow, but it's still buggy. One of the issues that I've had is some of the hotkeys, they don't always do the same thing every time. Like I've been doing lots of panoramas and stuff, so I'll hit the Control M for panorama and suddenly it's like exporting photos to like Nick Color Effects Pro or something. Yes. And then
it's like Control Surprise.
Exactly. but on the positive side, like one of the things that you guys didn't mention the other day when you had talked about some of the new updates is, and it's such a small thing, but I really like it. It's with your adjustment brush, two of the controls that they've added to the adjustment brush are the whites and the blacks. So you can actually, like, one of the ways I like to use it is in the darker parts of the of a landscape image or something. I like to boost the whites and it just adds a little bit of contrast to the darker parts of the image. And if you were to do that globally, like, your highlights are going to go crazy. But if you, it's really cool to be able to add that stuff locally.
Oh, that's a good tip. Didn't even notice that was in there.
Yeah. In both in the adjustment brush and in the, gradient.
Yeah, gradient and gradient.
Huh, yep. Very cool. Well, the other thing I wanted to mention real quick, my 5 minutes is rapidly coming to an end, is the dehaze slider. It is awesome. I'm going to have to email somebody from Adobe and see if somebody can explain to me in a technical way what exactly it's doing to do this, because it's not just adding contrast. So what it is, you know, the example is you shoot on a foggy day, you use the dehaze filter and poof, there goes the fog. I think everybody has been a little bit surprised at how well it works for removing fog. Adding fog, meh, sometimes it works, usually it doesn't. But I think everybody's surprised that has tried it on how well it works. Somebody mentioned before we recorded a cool tip about using this for fireworks. And that is a great tip, because what happens is the first pop of fireworks, 4th of July is this week, for those of you in the United States, is, you know, crystal clear. And then there's all that smoke from the first fireworks that the later ones just have a major, well, haze in the sky. So use the dehaze filter and it'll really give the fireworks photos that crystal clear look. I have been using it on night photos and, like, jaw-droppingly big difference. I'm going back on all my night photos, you know, photos of the Milky Way, star photos, and just using the dehaze filter. Before I drop the blacks, and that would work really well, dehaze does better. Again, I don't know exactly technically what it's doing, but you know how when you take a star photo, how the sky just sometimes feels just gray, like the area between the stars just feels just gray? Dehaze is beautiful for that situation. So you haven't checked that out, definitely worth taking a look at. All right, Brian, what do you got for us?
Well, I think all you guys did go over your 5 minutes, so I'm going to make up for that. You're welcome. I'm not going to take 5 minutes, but I just want to reiterate just kind of similar to what Darren was saying about the importance of community. And I talked about that on one of my recent podcasts with Thoughts on Photography. But I just saw a great example of that again up in Chicago, just the photographers working together, helping each other out. You know, one of the shots, it took, 15 of us physically in order to make one of the shots happen, the octopus dress that you found. Uh-huh. And so just, you know, working together and then seeing how other people see things is just extremely important. And from doing that, going to on some of the photo walks we did, just shooting what you don't normally shoot. You know, I tend to mainly do weddings and I do a lot of travel photography and then some sports stuff here and there. I don't really do a lot of portrait things that include lighting. And so one whole day was that, where we were shooting a model with a dress and different ways we were lighting her up with the flashes. And then another gentleman who was an athlete who we did some sports type of shots with. And none of those are really the typical shots that I do. And so it was a little bit out of my comfort zone, but I was able to sit there and I learned a lot. And from that and seeing how, you know, how the examples you gave of setting up your flashes and just testing one at a time to see the impact that that one flash is going to make. And so just by shooting or by observing different shoots than what I normally do, I learned a lot that I feel I can now take back and apply to what I kind of specialize on. And I just think that there's a lot of value in that, in shooting what you don't shoot normally.
Yeah, that's a great point. Somebody told me at the end of the of that workshop before the conference, I can't remember who it was, but one of the participants said, you know what? I just never would have had the confidence to do a shoot like this, you know, to go get a model and rent this amazing dress that we were using and shoot. You know, we had like, I don't know, who knows how many speed lights we had going on some of those shots. And she said, I would never have the confidence to do this. So it was so cool to do it in a setting like this with a group. And she said, you know, after this point, I feel like the simpler shoots I can do. I have the confidence to do now that I've done something this, you know, complicated and higher end kind of shoot. And that's totally true. When you go out and shoot with a group, you kind of see what other people are doing and you say, and you know, after you've seen other people do it, you say, oh, you know, maybe I could pull this off. And it just really, really helps your confidence and shows you different avenues. Great, great point.
One thing it doesn't always help is your wallet in your pocket. You know, I came back now and on Amazon, I end up buying the, one of the flash boxes and the monopod that you had and some gels. So my wallet's going to feel the impact of that a little bit.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, good transition to the doodad of the week, which tell us about some of the stuff you did get.
Some of the things that I got.
Yeah. Like what's your product of the week? Which one, what most excited you that you saw from other people?
Oh, I mean, there were so many different things. I think really, I guess my doodad would be just the gels, just seeing the way that we had the different colored gels in different spots and on the flashes when we were shooting an athlete, and just the way it brought in the different colors when we were in such a dark area, kind of under that tunnel. That was one thing right away where I'm like, okay, I don't really do much with gels, but I could see how this could make some cool creative shots, especially at some of the wedding receptions that I shoot. So that would be my doodad.
And if you want to see the photos from that shoot of the dress and the sports shoot that Brian's talking about, check. I don't know if you have any up on your Instagram yet, Brian. On my Instagram, I have a lot of those photos. That's Jim Harmer on Instagram. If you search Improved Photography on Instagram, you're going to be taken to an old account that we don't do anything with. So search our names individually. I think just about all of us are on Instagram, and you can see a lot of all the photos that we're talking about. In fact, just come follow us on Instagram, and then by the time you get to the podcast, you'll already know what photos we're talking about. All right, Jeff, how about you?
Mine's a do-don't instead of a do-dad. We talked about 3 terabyte hard drives, how they've kind of had a bad history. And if that's the size of hard drive that you've got, you might want to consider replacing it because they've had a higher failure rate for whatever reason. Well, Backblaze, I wish other cloud providers would offer the same information, tell us their failure rates that they're seeing from their hard drives. But Backblaze is the only one I've seen do that. Anyway, they released some more data and it got even worse for a couple of brands or a couple of specific models where their failure rates were just way higher. It was more than twice the others. And so it's the Seagate Barracuda 7200.11, which is a 1.5 terabyte drive, or the 7200.14 3 terabyte drives. Both of those, if you've got those and you're lucky enough that they haven't given up yet, you need to replace those. They're for whatever reason, I don't know what the problem is with them. They've just had massive failure rates compared to the others. So don't get those.
Darren?
Mine's along the same lines. I listened to Jeff's tip. He was actually right. I had a 3 terabyte Seagate drive and I'm not sure exactly which one it was, but I was ready to go off to Colorado and then Chicago soon afterwards. And I plugged it into back of my Drobo because I always want to back it up with another drive that I put in a safety deposit box. And I turned it on to spin it up and it just started making a sound like a bicycle when you put a playing card
in
a paperclip. It's like,
it's done.
Yep, it was done. And so I just said, you know, go ahead and order it on Amazon, Dad. So he ordered the Western Digital 4 terabyte external drive. It's the Western Digital MyBook Studio drive. It's aluminum. It's pretty cool. It matches my Mac and it's 4 terabytes. So hopefully it's going to have a much lower failure rate than the 3 terabyte ones.
Very cool. Nick?
Mine's going to have to be the cheap monopod. It doesn't really matter what brand. I got a couple of them at Walmart, but I use them all the time for when I'm using lighting and I have an assistant, and it's so much better than having just a light stand that's stationary. If you have somebody holding your light on the end of a monopod, it's like perfect. And also, obviously, when you have a GoPro and you're doing underwater stuff and you're going to ruin whatever you're using, a nice cheap monopod is definitely the way to go. So cheap monopods.
You mentioned about having the, you know, somebody can hold the flash on the end of the stick. Well, why not just like a selfie stick for flash? And you can have like the person that you're shooting just hold the selfie stick.
Yeah, exactly. And with the GoPro and the monopod, I was using it as a selfie stick. So I was like swimming underwater and it was pretty awesome.
Oh man, that'd be so cool if somebody had just a bunch of selfie stick.
Mm-hmm.
sorry, inside joke. And my doodad this week, there are a lot of things, but the one that I want to point out is the Siray monopod, since we're on the topic. The Siray monopod, that's S-I-R-U-I. It's like spelled Sarui. You can get that on Amazon.com. I also have Walmart monopods, Nick, and I do actually regularly use them. They're actually not that bad. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to shoot a 600 on them, but I don't really use it for that, for a monopod. I'm usually using them to hold up a flash and stuff, and it just doesn't need to hold very much weight. But the Siray monopod is definitely my favorite monopod. It's pretty inexpensive, and the advantage of it is it has, I think it has 5 sections, so it gets really tall, but it's so compact. I can chuck it in a Pelican case. It fits in a backpack. I mean, it's just really, really tiny. So when I want to take flash on location and we're using off-camera flash, I just have that tiny little monopod that's pretty strong and very, very lightweight, and just pop a flash on the end of the monopod and poop, you're up there. Now, one thing you're going to need when you do this, rather than using light stands, I can't stand working with light stands. If you're going to put it on a monopod instead and just have somebody hold it, is you're going to need a little stud, the little adapter to go from the tripod screw on the top of the monopod to the standard little connector that you can put on an umbrella bracket on that to put a flash. I need to do a post on Improved Photography showing how to make a light stick like that. But it's very inexpensive parts. And once you have one of those, you'll find you rarely even use your light stand anymore.
That's the monopod that I just bought yesterday on Amazon.
Oh, oh nice. Brian, for you, $100. I'm going to wake up 30 minutes early and post it on improvephotography.com for you.
Yes, thank you.
Using monopods for your lights, it totally spoils you. Like once you have that mobile light stand that is an assistant, like it's really hard to go back to just a regular old light stand.
Yeah, and every time we talk about that, I always get blowback of people always saying, yeah, sure, you have assistants and stuff. I know, I'm just getting started. Oh, come on. Ask a spouse to come help you out for half an hour. Grab the teenage neighbor kid and pay him $10 of your $100 shoot. Just grab somebody. They do not need to know anything about photography. Just bring a friend when you go out and shoot and have them just hold the flash and tell them where to put it. I can't afford an assistant. It's not an excuse. Just bring a friend. It doesn't have to be anybody special. Just bring somebody to hold the flash. It makes a huge difference. It makes the whole day go so much easier.
And I'll do preferably, it for free because you called me a stud.
There you go.
I was going to say preferably somebody that can stand on your back.
Preferably that. Brian was standing on me. We couldn't get the light quite high enough for one of the shoots, so I got down on all fours and Brian jumped up on my back. But we got that shot. It looked cool.
We did.
All right, everybody. It was fun chatting with you for this week, and we will see you in another 7 days.